I'm Melody Simmons, and this is Midday. The consensus among many mayoral candidates these days is that Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano must go. This week, the Housing Authority said it would attempt to settle with 11 women who allege housing maintenance workers sought sex in return for repairs. And recent reports have highlighted, once again, deplorable conditions in public housing. WBAL-TV's veteran reporter Jane Miller gives us the details. Plus, we speak with a local hero who has embarked on a needed mission in some of the city's schools. And we will hear about a long-standing football rivalry between Gilman and McDonough. Capping it all off, songbird Victoria Vox will serenade us into the weekend with her ukulele. That's Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Melody Simmons, sitting in for a vacationing Sheila Cast. Glad you're joining us. Coming up later in the hour, a history lesson on a legendary Baltimore High School football rivalry. No, it's not City versus Poly, which will be played tomorrow for the 127th time. Or it's not the Turkey Bowl either, the annual Loyola versus Calvert Hall clash each Thanksgiving. That's going to be 96 years old later this month. This one is between Gilman and McDonough. On Saturday at McDonough's sprawling Owings Mills campus, close to 10,000 fans are expected to attend the 100th meeting of these two schools. Steve Jones from PressBox will join us to give us a preview. And we'll meet a local hero, Sandy Nagel, a former teacher and society columnist for the Jewish Times, who saw a need to start a weekend food program for homeless school kids. And because it's Friday, we'll end the week with a little music. Victoria Vox will be here with her ukulele to sing us a song or two. Up front, there's an issue that several of Baltimore's 2016 mayoral candidates, including former Mayor Sheila Dixon, Councilman Nick Mosby and Carl Stokes, State Senator Catherine Pugh, and businessman David Warnock can all agree on. Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano should go. He's been at his job for 15 years and served under three mayors, and lately he's been at the center of controversy. Some public housing residents this fall have protested against a lack of heat and hot water at certain public housing developments. Paul Graziano toured some of these developments to see firsthand some of the decrepit conditions. At the beginning of the week, it was announced that the Housing Authority of Baltimore City, or HABC, and 11 female residents of public housing who are alleging a sex for repair scandal involving housing maintenance workers will enter into settlement discussions in January. The women filed a lawsuit against the agency in late September. Since then, the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office and the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Inspector General's Office have launched investigations. Adding to the debate, the Baltimore Sun last Saturday published a story that said the HABC had eliminated the position of its inspector general there as a cost-saving measure at the end of 2014. That office is designed to root out misconduct and hold employees of the HABC responsible for negligent actions. Joining us by phone now to discuss the latest controversies in the HABC is Jane Miller, the lead investigative reporter for WBAL-TV, who has covered the story from City Hall. Jane, welcome to Midday.
Hey, Melody. How are you doing?
Okay. How are you?
Good. Good. It's a summer day out there. It's hard to not be a good on a day like today.
It's really great. I know. We're having a treat. This might be the last hurrah.
Yeah, really.
Well, I wanted just to talk about housing in general. Let's just set the table a little bit. Baltimore housing has two components. It has the HABC and the city's Department of Housing.
Correct.
Paul Graziano heads both departments, even though one is federal and one is city. Do these
correct.
Departments
and
overlap?
And there's federal money involved in both. That's correct.
Right.
Yes.
So they overlap because the federal money's involved in both.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So
he answers to actually the mayor, and then he also answers to a board of commissioners for housing for HABC. But we all know, you and I both know, that he's the mayor's appointee and has been the mayoral appointee through three administrations.
For three mayors. And how sticky does that get when you have two separate controversies rolling right now? The city council wants to hold a hearing, and they're not able to get to that hearing because, they're going to hold it, but how much power and will do they really have?
Well, I think the real key here is the Inspector General for Housing and Urban Development is involved, and they're really going to peel back the layers of and they're going to look at things that are not in the public eye. So this what's in the public eye at the moment about Paul Graziano is that his agency has been sued because there are female residents who allege that there was a sex for repair scheme going on in which the maintenance workers allegedly demanded sex in order to get their units repaired. That's, as you mentioned, that there's some discussion now going on of settlement talks.
Right.
In addition, there's been a lot of pressure lately because there have been some of the public housing buildings, Lakeview Terrace, et cetera, that have went a couple of days without heat and water.
Right.
And that has obviously, but these are just, you know, these are just the most recent controversies.
Exactly.
You and I both covered a couple of years ago when the lawyers for the plaintiffs in some lead paint lawsuits were tagging vehicles, repossessing vehicles belonging to the housing authority in order to get these lawsuits paid because the judgments weren't being paid.
That's right.
And, of course, we can go all the way back to the beginning, back in 2000. Graziano was named and sworn in late 2000. In December of 2000, he was arrested for disorderly conduct because of an admitted drunken episode inside a Fells Point bar,
Bertha's,
to be specific, in which he made some pretty disparaging remarks, homophobic remarks, which was the result of that was that, well, that was then Mayor Martin O'Malley. I'll never forget that news conference with the two of them sitting there.
Right.
That Graziano was given leave to go into alcohol rehab and then came back in February of 2001 and went back on the job, and he's been there ever since. And over the years, there have been other controversies. Look, this is a thankless job in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough job. You have the maintenance and repair of thousands of units. You have a waiting list in Section 8 that you've got to deal with. So you have to oversee the Section 8 program, which is individual properties or whatever that are privately owned, but you have to oversee them.
Right.
You have to oversee the demand for them. And then you also have to oversee 11,000 actual public housing units.
That's correct.
So it's a tough job. There's no question about that. I think that we have all been kind of amazed that he has lasted all this time.
That seems to be the sentiment.
Yeah, and I think that there's just a certain amount of, political science minor in college, and there's this, and the political scientists out there can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's called the coalition of minorities. That's not minority in like an ethnic sense, but just in the sense that over time, all these little things really start to catch up with you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is now not a little thing. He's got a big thing in front of him, and with this lawsuit and these allegations, and it's really just a scandal. It's just scandalous.
It is scandalous.
That you would have, and then there's been this kind of a sideshow of it with, you know, people being suspended because they claim they spoke up, and it's just been a really unsightly, episode in the history of this particular agency. I think that, Melody, honestly, one of the questions that you could probably do an entire show on this, one of the things that I have really scratched my head about is that Baltimore is now the, 25th or 26th largest city in the country, but it has the fifth largest public housing operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a reasonable policy question is if the city, these three administrations have, done enough to try to get away from that particular model.
Right.
I mean, we've all been in these housing projects, and look, I've been here long enough to remember the high rises, and they were horrible.
They were horrible.
I mean, they were like 20-story prisons.
We did reporting there many years ago.
Absolutely. And getting rid of them was a good thing. What we're talking about now are mostly mid-rise projects, the Gilmore Homes, the Latrobe Homes, those kinds of projects. in Fells Point, in Upper Fells Point, there's the Perkins Homes projects,
right,
that are not high rises, but they're still clearly a public housing project.
Right, and they are in disrepair, and they're old.
They're old, mm-hmm. And there's only so much you can do to continue to kind of patch together. I mean, Graziano has led this effort to get private investment involved in repair, et cetera, and a bit of a different model of ownership, et cetera, but I do think that in the broader sense, there is a really fair question to be asked about whether there's not a better way to do business in subsidized housing. And I think the answer is a resounding yes. We just have to figure out how to do it.
Well, I think we're seeing a sea change. I definitely agree with you on that. And they are selling 40% of the public housing units.
Correct.
To private developers. And this mm-hmm. is the beginning of what could be the end of public housing in Baltimore,
as we know
ultimately.
That's correct.
As we know it.
And probably has taken too long. I've often said that one of the advantages of the Section 8 program is that they are privately owned, and then you have a lot of leverage to hold them accountable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of downsides to the program too, but the upside of something like that is that you have private ownership of these units and you can hold them to a standard. There are many people, many property owners that want to be involved in Section 8 because of the flow of income, and it's one way. So this is, you're right. I mean, this is the idea of having now private ownership in part of these, kind of these mid-rise projects and some of the other projects could be, yes, the beginning of the end to the public housing as we know it.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, getting back to the controversy, without an inspector general at HABC, do you think that this issue that led to the lawsuit was ignored?
I don't know.
Generally,
inspector generals are looking at financial matters. And I think one of the things that was just as of interest to me is that if the housing authority is interested in settling this lawsuit fast, that probably means that there's some couple of things that they don't really want to become public. I just have to say as an aside about the issue of the inspector general, when you and I were covering the effort by the lawyers for the plaintiffs and the lead paint settlements to repossess the vehicles that belonged to. There was one of the vehicles that was repossessed that day that was a take-home vehicle,
mm-hmm.
which caused me, as things generally do, is like, oh, I smell something here, caused me to request information and then take a look at that whole practice. Well, it turned out, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it turned out that they had about 36 employees of housing that were being permitted to take home publicly owned vehicles, either owned by the Housing Authority or Housing and Community Development, the other side of the agency, and without any kind of practice or policy about how far, what if somebody lived in another state, what if somebody lived 50 miles away. And the irony of that story was that the employee who lived the furthest away and was given a take-home vehicle was the Inspector General at that time.
Mm-hmm.
She lived down in La Plata, and if you know where that is, it's all the way down in southern Maryland.
It's far.
She was driving, 140 miles or something like that a day, coming back and forth. And if you've also ever made that trip, you know that that is a horrible rush hour drive. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just really crowded in that part of the state. And it's just, kind of the irony of it is that you've got this, you're allowing this, perk to all these employees, mostly administrators and, higher-level managers. And the one who has the best of it is your inspector general, the very person that you would think would be trying to keep tabs on that kind of thing. So,
right, and stay above it.
I think there's been some of that. This is an agency that has had a lot to do with some of the most pressing issues in Baltimore.
Right.
And again, one of the things that hasn't been brought up, but I think if you were to look at the career of Paul Graziano in Baltimore, one of the things you have to ask yourself is that the blight hasn't gotten discernibly better. It's mm-hmm. gotten discernibly worse in the
yes.
worst parts.
You can just drive around the city and see it.
Absolutely. And yes, there's a vacancy to value program, which is having some effect in a couple of places. But I think it's a fair question that has there been an aggressive attempt to get rid of the blight?
Now, of course, Commissioner Graziano claims that there's not enough money. He says he needs about $800 million to make repairs and renovations to a lot of the units. So he blames a lot of the funding issues on that. We did get a statement this morning from Tanya Baker, and it says, quote, Executive Director Paul T. Graziano is committed to the citizens of Baltimore and is focused on working to improve the conditions at the Housing Authority of Baltimore City Developments to ensure that residents have safe, livable, and affordable housing opportunities.
Yeah, that's been the statement of the week. Well, it's because of the calls from, you know, you mentioned it, these people running for mayor that include, you know, Sheila Dixon and Nick Mosby, et cetera, that have called on him to resign.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor was very, very vocally supportive of him over the past month, calling him, you know, saying he had her full support, calling
exactly.
him one of the best housing commissioners in the country. This week, when she was asked about, you know, to respond to these calls from others for him to resign, she said they've made it a political thing, and I'm not going to comment. But my understanding out of City Hall is that no, he's not going anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and that she is in his corner. I mean, look, we're in this long lame duck period, as I call it,
yep.
in the city of Baltimore. So you're going to see turnover because people aren't going to hang around for the next year. Well, it's a little more. It's 13 months, I guess, before we have a new mayor and sworn in anyways. And so you're going to see, a fair amount of turnover in Baltimore because of the folks that have been working under the Rawlings-Blake administration and prior administrations are not necessarily going to be retained. So
for the remainder.
So I would have anticipated that, that Graziano would be looking to move on anyways.
And it's going to be interesting to see who might take over, even on an interim basis, because it's a complex job. You're head of two departments, as we said, and it's very, you know, it's troubled. It's troubled and it's rocking right now.
Well, and they do have a, you know, leadership team. And, that happens all the time in agencies where you have, this period of time where you might have to have an interim, et cetera. But, like I said, we don't have any indication at all that Graziano is going to vacate that job.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be watching it. Jane, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
Us. Yeah, Jane, we'll be watching this evolving story. Jane, this is Jane Miller, lead investigative reporter for WBAL-TV. And thank you again for joining us.
All right, Melody. Have a good day.
You too. We have to take a quick break now. When we return, we will meet a local hero who last year started a project that has made a big impact on many young lives. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Melody Simmons. Joining us now is Sandy Nagel. She's a former English and social studies teacher who also wrote a society column for the Jewish Times for 18 years. Late last year, Sandy Nagel dropped off some hats and scarves for needy school students at Tench Tillman Elementary Middle in East Baltimore. It was then that she learned that the school had about 100 homeless students enrolled. Overall, there are about 3,000 homeless kids in the city. Sandy Nagel, welcome to Midday. Tell us, what was the first thought that came to your mind after you learned that?
First, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming in.
I thought of Ellen DeGeneres. Ellen DeGeneres had a show about a little boy who was doing these weekend backpacks for homeless kids. And I thought, if he could do it, I'm going to feed these kids. And I said to the two social workers, Rosie and Stephanie, we're going to feed these kids.
And so it was right then and there that your new project, which is called Weekend Backpacks for Homeless Kids, was born. You made your first delivery on March 14th, and today you have 36 backpacks that go out every Friday to homeless school children at two city schools, Tench Tillman and John Rura in Greektown, and one small nursery school in Park Heights.
Yes. And we're very proud to say that we're growing. We have four schools waiting for us to get more funding. And We're ready to go.
Describe the need out there.
The need is very sad because these children, these 3,000 children, the only stability in their life probably is the school. They are allowed to attend any school, and the city provides transportation from where they are staying. These kids are doubled up. They call it doubled up or couch surfing, where the family is living with another family, a grandmother, a relative, a friend. Others stay in motels, and this time of year they go into the welfare hotels because of the weather. Some are even living in the parks.
And so these are the homeless children, and they're registered as such with the school system.
That's correct.
And so what do you put in the backpacks every week? Because they're eligible for free lunch and free breakfast in school.
Every day at school, they get the free breakfast. They get a hot lunch. I'm proud to say they get a fresh fruit every afternoon. And before they get home, because most of them stay late, they get a sandwich of some sort. When they leave on Friday, there is no food till Monday morning. And if there is a school holiday or a professional study day, they could go 4 days without any food. There are stories of kids who have walked in on Monday morning and fainted in the hallway. There are stories of kids, little ones, that cry on Friday knowing they have to leave school and there'll be no food.
So the backpacks are kind of a savior for them. And what do you put in the backpacks every week?
Well, we decided our philosophy from the beginning was that the child does not live in isolation. We have one family that has seven children at Tench Tillman, and they get two backpacks a week. We put a quart of milk, the shelf milk. We put a big box of cereal, regular size 11 to 15 ounce box. We put proteins such as beefaroni. We put tuna. We put pork and beans. We put vegetables, corn. The kids love the corn. And we put these little sausages, which the kids, okay, I want the little hot dogs.
Uh-huh.
And we give them applesauce and we give them pudding. And we give them peanut butter and jelly and bread once a month. And it rotates. We have a four-week rotation. In the beginning of the month, we go light on the backpacks because the families still have some money or have just received their money. At the end of the month, we're very heavy.
On that. And how many people does each backpack feed, do you estimate?
We estimate that it feeds anywhere between 4 and 6. And statistics show that some of the schools use the entire backpack up by Sunday night, but most of them last until Tuesday, if you think about it, with a big bag of cereal and the milk and the juices. And we only use 100% juice.
Talk a little bit about these children and their families. Some of them, as you said, live in hotels and motels, some shelter, some on the street, some with relatives. They're trying really hard to stay in school.
Well, we just had a 78-year-old grandmother come to the school and asked for our names so that she could pray for us, because she has a first grader, a second grader, and a fourth grader. And she is maintaining these children on the little income she has. She said without our backpacks, they would be starving. We have a 12-year-old boy who wanted to travel across the entire city to get to a shelter because he could no longer go to the female shelter. With his siblings and his mother. These children, if you go in the school, you couldn't tell the homeless from the non-homeless. They're adorable. They're working hard. Miss Jan, the principal, has done an amazing job at Tench Tillman, and their scores are coming up and up and up, which proves what a great job is going on with the teachers and the faculty. And we're just so proud to be part of this family.
Now, over the past year, the program has evolved a little bit. You're starting to grow a little bit. Talk a little bit about the evolution. It all has come together. When you first got the backpacks, talk about how you got your backpacks.
Well, first of all, the first thing I found out was you couldn't accept money unless you had a 501c. So I quickly called Miriam Lodge's president, Norma Sampson, and I'm a past president, the oldest independent women's organization in Maryland. And I said, I need a 501c. And Miriam Lodge said, fine. The board didn't even blink. We got the backpacks. I was at a Shiva house. Somebody in Baltimore told me they were collecting money for something. I said, I'm collecting for backpacks. Referred me to somebody in New York who referred me to somebody in the Hamptons who happened to be a friend of my son in Baltimore and referred us to the backpack people in Orlando, Florida, who gave us the first group of backpacks.
So all the way around now, the world, you came a small world, but there was a Baltimore connection.
There was a Baltimore connection.
And you have a lot of partners. I call them loosely partners, but you get a lot of donations every month. Talk a little bit about how that has helped your program really get off to a good start.
Well, first of all, 100% of the money goes to the food. And the first week, my husband and I schlepped the canned goods into our house, which was about 20 feet from the car. Figured it out very quickly. That was not going to work. So we partnered with the Chimes. The most incredible experience. The clients at the Chimes who are challenged, they know they're feeding the homeless kids and the hungry kids. They call them the homeless kids, hungry kids. So every week they pack the backpacks for us. And I get chastised every once in a while that the cereal is a little bit less, 11 ounces, not 15 ounces by them. The other partnership we formed was ShopRite. ShopRite Howard Park. The staff there has just embraced us, is all I can tell you. And every week I find something in the order that I didn't plan. Like, there's always a case of apples given for the kids, or fruit or vegetables. And Andy Klein has been amazing and has told us that he is matching us for every dollar we spend. He's donating a dollar. So that has been. And the women of Miriam Lodge have gone above and beyond the call of duty. We've just had a first fundraiser, and we did very well and raised enough money for 4 months of backpacks.
That's excellent. And I know that you said the school you used to teach at, Krieger-Schechter Day School, is helping out this year, too. Describe how the kids there, the school kids there, are going to be helping after the first of the year.
Well, the kids in each grade are going to get an assignment to bring in, like first grade is going to bring peanut butter, second grade jelly, third grade corn, fourth grade beefaroni, and so on and so forth. And then they're going to bring it in and physically pack the bags. And I hope we're supposed to do it in January, March, and May, and I'm very proud.
And you've worn many hats in your life. Tell us what you have learned from this. What is the lesson that you've learned from starting Weekend Backpacks?
I've been in fundraising all my life. I've always done something in fundraising, and it's always a rewarding experience. But I have to tell you, I feel like there's an angel on my shoulder, and I truly believe that this community has just come out beyond anything I could ever imagine. I don't even know. Everything has been word of mouth. This is the first time we've gone public. We haven't had any publicity. And even this week, I woke up on Monday morning to find out we had this amazing donation from this foundation for $5,000. The Golden Foundation is based in New Jersey, and it was from Washington, D.C. that we got it. And how they found out about us is through one of my volunteers' husband, and they're mainly focused on the arts, and now they're focused on feeding kids.
So this is wonderful, and that $5,000 will probably go into it filling more backpacks, buying more backpacks and filling them up.
We've already signed up two schools.
Lovely. Now, how can others get involved?
We need people to shop, pick up the food at ShopRite. We need people to come to the Chimes, and we need people to deliver the food to the schools. Right now, I have a small volunteer dedicated force. And, of course, the one thing we need is money. And the tax-deductible funds can be sent to Miriam Lodge at 7310 Park Heights Avenue, and that's 21208. Or we have a GoFundMe site. We've gone techie. And it's Weekend Backpacks, the number for kids.
And you have a Facebook page as well.
We have a Facebook page, Weekend Backpacks, number for kids. And we would love to hear from anybody that would want to donate to us.
This is great. Sandy Nagel, thank you so much for joining us at Midday. If you'd like more information, you can email Sandy. Give us your email address.
My email address is playbound, P-L-A-Y-B as in boy, O-U-N-D, Sandy, S-A-N-D-I-E, at yahoo.com.
And we have the contact information on Facebook. So Stay with us. We're going to have to take another short break. When we come back, we're going to meet Steve Jones of PressBox Online, and he's going to take us back to the start of the rivalry between two football teams at two Baltimore private schools, Gilman and McDonough. Plus, we're going to hear from musician Victoria Vox, who's going to bring her ukulele in the studio and play us a couple of songs for the weekend. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Melody Simmons, sitting in for Sheila Cast. It's a safe bet that most of you out there listening weren't around in 1914. Just to give you some details, Charlie Chaplin and Cecil B. DeMille were the heavyweights in Hollywood. The U.S. was involved in fighting World War I, and Woodrow Wilson was in the White House. Lots has changed since then, but some things have not. Consider two local schools, the Gilman School and McDonough. They have been playing each other on the football field since 1914. Tomorrow, their football teams, members of the Maryland Interscholastic Athletic Association, or MIAA, will mark the game centennial. Kickoff is set for 3 p.m. at John McDonough Stadium in Owings Mills. It is the second oldest interscholastic rivalry in the state of Maryland, and alumni will be watching it online via stream broadcast from cities that include Atlanta, Chicago, San Francisco, and Seattle. Joining us in the studio to discuss this local grudge match is Steve Jones. He's contributor to PressBox and author of Gilman vs. McDonough since 1914. Steve Jones, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Melody.
So tell us a little bit about this game. Lots going on in line for the first place Gilman Greyhounds.
It's not only the 100th meeting, but as always, it will be a fiercely fought game. There's a lot at stake. Gilman currently holds first place by themselves in the MIAA conference, and McDonough and Mount St. Joe tied for second at 4-1. So there's a lot going on besides celebrating just the 100th game tomorrow.
Yeah, as always. If you have any comments or questions, if you're an alumni of either school, give us a call at 410-662-8780 or toll free at 866-661-9309, or you can send an email to midday@wypr.org. We would love to hear from anybody who went to those schools, who's played in these games. This is an exciting time. So talk a little bit about this. Is this the last game of the season?
It is the last game of the season, and they finished up with each other for probably going on 50-some years now. It's always been the last game of the year. It's always been the climactic game, the rivalry game, and that's usually what happens with a lot of high school, college rivalries. They try to pit the rivals together last week of the season.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Loyola and Calvert Hall, the Turkey Bowl, always the last game as well.
Correct. Loyola, Calvert Hall, City Poly.
City Poly tomorrow.
Is another one. Those rivalries have been around. Calvert Hall, Loyola has been around, I think, 96 years, and City Poly has been around for well over 100. But Gilman McDonough is right there with these two other rivalries in terms of, you know, what it means to the school, not just the football teams.
Mm-hmm. And what's the spirit? What's going on in these schools today? I mean, just the walk up to the game itself.
This rivalry is built on mutual respect, and I think that that's shown during the week prior to the game. They have a visitation day for each school. Administrators and players from Gilman will travel to McDonough, and McDonough will reciprocate. They go and speak to each other's student bodies. It's very indicative of how respectful this rivalry has been over the years.
And I know that there's some older alums that really look back to this game and this period of time in their high school life and their high school career, and some were players as well, and just remember it as being so special. Did you come across some of those good stories?
There were a lot of people who remember the score of the Gilman-McDonough game their senior year, 50 years later. And, you know, that tells you how special this rivalry is and how meaningful it is for the people that participate in it. Gilman, you know, leads the rivalry. McDonough won last year's game. It's always an interesting game, and it's a game that people will always remember, players and alumni.
Right, and I do believe there was some drama at the end of the game last year.
There was. It was the first overtime game in the history of the Gilman-McDonough rivalry. And McDonough actually won the game in the first overtime period on a recovered fumble. So that enabled them to tie Gilman for the MIAA Conference Championship. And, you know, certainly, you know, you see games like that. Mickey Deegan, who was the athletic director at McDonough, been mm-hmm. there for 28 years, said she believed that it was the best game in the rivalry that she's seen in that entire time. So, you know, hopefully these teams are pretty evenly matched and might be that kind of game tomorrow.
So tomorrow with the 100th anniversary, how high are the spirits going to be?
I think they'll be sky high on both sidelines in the stands. You're talking about, you know, the game is at McDonough, and they're bringing in extra seating for the game. I think they'll be able to seat 8,000, but they, at the time that I wrote the story, they said with a nice day they might expect 10,000 people to be at the game tomorrow. So there's
a
tremendous amount of interest in this game. And, again, it's not just the football teams and the coaches. It's the rivalries.
What's the breakdown of wins and losses for Gilman and McDonough in this? Do you know?
Yeah, Gilman is up 59-35, and there have been five ties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that adds up to 100. 1 year, there was a Gilman-McDonough playoff game. I think it was 2012. So it's 59-35-5, but they did play that one additional game when the MIAA briefly had a playoff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that doesn't happen any longer. This is now the end of the season for both teams.
Right. And the winner gets the Dave Price Trophy.
That's right.
Who was Dave Price?
I'm not sure who Dave Price was. That's
okay.
A great question. But the David Price Trophy is awarded to the winner of the game. What's nice about it is that both teams, after battling each other for 2.5-3 hours, will gather on the field together. The headmasters will come out together and present the trophy and address both teams. The sportsmanship that mm-hmm. is shown was really one of the great features that I found out in doing the work for the story.
And a lot of civility. And I
absolutely.
Know that you talked about doing some research. How about how many archives did these schools have for their athletic games?
Well, you go back 100 years and, you know, you look at Steve Amidown from Gilman and Mary Lou Greenwood from McDonough, who were very helpful. A gentleman named Matt Kennedy, who has written a book called Gilman versus McDonough, the Football Rivalry, was also very helpful in, you know, giving me a sense of what the rivalry was all about and, you know, providing a lot of the details, and there's a lot of details when you're talking about 100 years of a football rivalry.
And I understand in your article you talked a little bit about the day that John F. Kennedy was shot. Talk a little bit about that. That was the day of one of these games.
That was the day of the 1963 McDonough game, November 22nd, 1963. The game was played on a Friday in the afternoon, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours before game time. President Kennedy had been shot. The players were not told of the assassination. They learned about it. Most of them learned about it after the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I wrote about Tom Beck, the Gilman captain of that 1963 team. He was told by his coach Redmond Finney afterwards, and just wanted the squad to gather together and pray for the country. Gilman lost that game to McDonough that day, but the country suffered a lot greater loss.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In Baltimore, it seems, we talked a lot about the Turkey Bowl. We talked about City Poly. But in Baltimore, it's just a tradition. Where you went to high school matters. Talk a little bit about that. What's that all about?
This is the only place I've lived, so I can't really compare it to other cities. But there is a closeness in Baltimore that when people ask you where you went to school, they mean high school. They don't mean college. I went to Towson University, but when people ask me where I went to school, and when I ask them, we reveal where we went to high school first. That's very unique in the sense that, even people who have gone on to other schools after high school still take great pride in their high school and, what their high school years meant to them. And that's no exception with McDonough and Gilman, who have sent a lot of people to some very prestigious colleges and universities and beyond,
and
into
even
the business
pros,
world.
Some of the
and
players.
The pros, right. Mm-hmm. But, it's all about where you went to high school.
It's funny. We did get an email here from Tom in Baltimore, and he writes, as a baby boomer who attended both Gilman and McDonough, I note that while folks my age remember where they were when they learned of John Kennedy's assassination, I also recall how odd it was that when we all boarded the buses at Gilman to head out to McDonough for the big game. Could your guests confirm that fact? And please comment on the game. It wasn't postponed that day. They went ahead and played that game, even in light of what had occurred with the assassination.
Right. They did go ahead and play that game.
The players weren't aware.
That's what I was told. Tom Beck said he heard something from one of the trainers. This was deep into the second half about the shooting. But they were not told before the game. McDonough won that game 8-7, and looking through some of the old footage, it was a gloomy day, so it kind of reflected the mood of the nation after President Kennedy's assassination.
Steve Jones of Press Box Online, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so enlightening. I know tomorrow's kickoff at 3 o'clock is going to be one for the books after that.
It should be a great game. There's some high stakes for these teams in particular, mm-hmm. and there's always high stakes, but a mutual respect there for both of the schools, and that's what really makes this rivalry special.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we turn our sights now to our special guest, Victoria Vox. If you don't already have plans for tonight, you might after hearing her play her ukulele. She's a Baltimore-based musician. She's graced the cover of Ukulele Magazine. And she's also been profiled in the Wall Street Journal. She's back in town after being touring in Europe later this month. Talk to us a little bit about that, Victoria. Where'd you go?
Traveling in Europe? Mm-hmm. Well, I just got back a little over a week and a half ago, and I was performing at the Grand Southern Ukulele Festival in Portsmouth, South Sea, UK, and then London, and then I went over to Brussels and Paris for shows.
It's amazing. You can catch her tonight at 7:30 p.m. at Live in the Lobby, a house show series located at 823 Park Avenue in Baltimore.
Yes.
What are you going to be playing tonight?
Well, tonight I will be an interesting intimate show. I'm going to be trying out some new songs, and I'll be doing some of my looping with the ukulele and vocals, and it'll be fun.
And tell us about your new album.
My new album is called When the Night Unravels, and it was released in January earlier this year, and it's a departure from the last record, which was a collection of songs written during my 2012 52 songwriting project, where I wrote a song a week for the year. And so that album was called Key. It was a very heartfelt group of songs with strings backing up on the album. And so this was the When the Night Unravels is a little jazzier departure using horns.
So the ukulele is a happy instrument, isn't it?
It can be, and it can be. I love writing sad songs on the ukulele, but I think because it's a ukulele, there's always a glimpse of hope. And so even when it's sad, there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Can you play us a song?
Sure. This is a tune called Supermoon. which is neither sad nor, I guess it could be happy. It's a bit, I call it the dirtiest ukulele song ever written, but it's not that bad. I'm just warning you. Mm-hmm. You know, how much sexier can you get with the moon and the tides?
Okay, let's hear it.
We are stars hanging in the universe, little sparks heating up the temperature, the energy sizzles in the galaxy, perigee, syzygy, come on closer next to me, fingertips dipping in the Milky Way, take a trip, come on now let's get away, me oh my, there's a hole in the sky, if we try we can fly higher than the highest high, supermoon, I'm waiting on a supermoon to come into view. On the horizon, this is real. Can you feel my body rise? Sex appeal, strong enough to change the tides. High or low, there's no need to take it slow. Overflow down below, I know somewhere we can go. Supermoon, I'm waiting on a supermoon to come. On the horizon, supermoon, I'm waiting on a supermoon to come into view. On the horizon, supermoon, you can snap along in your cars, supermoon.
Thank you, Victoria Vox. Awesome. And thanks so much to all our guests today for joining us. Lunch for today's guest was provided by Joe Squared. Joe Squared serves cold-fired pizza, risotto, and local craft beers. For locations and hours, visit joesquared.com. On Monday, the magazine Urbanite returns with a special issue that looks at healing Baltimore in the city's aftermath of the Freddie Gray death and riots. We talked to the magazine's publisher and contributing writers on Monday. Victoria, can you play us into the weekend?
Sure.
Thank you so much for joining us.